listening to Performance Anxiety on the Pantheon Podcast Network, and I am your host, Mark. And I don't even want to do an introduction to this episode because I just want to get into these stories. I'm joined by Simon Spence Dudfield and Martin Goodacre of Fabulous. They exploded and flamed out in a span of 18 months in the early 90s. But they accumulated a lifetime of stories in that blink of an eye. They weren't even musicians when they started the band. They're still not musicians. They had somewhere between 8 to 10 bassists in that year and a half. They even wrote a song about one. Well, it was Craig Pike, and he didn't technically join the band because he had died. But they did have Keanu Reeves in the band for a minute after stuffing him in the trunk of their car. Another member just wandered off stage mid-gig, never to be seen again. Almost. And speaking of shows, theirs were so volatile that they only lasted 10 to 15 minutes on average. And they were banned from the majority of venues that they played. They were kidnapped and beaten after one particularly intense show. They blew off chances to work with Andy Weatherall, Rick Rubin, and the Beastie Boys, and spoiled a chance at a $1 million contract. It's a short-lived musical career filled with destruction, fights, and regret. And it's possibly the most insane collection of stories I've ever heard in one place. Check out Fabulous wherever you get music. Follow them on the socials at FCKDXFabulous. Follow us at Performance ANX. Support us with merch at performanceanx.threadless.com or with coffee at ko-fi.com/performanceanxiety. You can also help with a 5-star rating or review. And now be prepared to lose your mind with Fabulous on Performance Anxiety on the Pantheon Podcast Network.
Okay, let me do it then, and then Martin can do it. My name's Simon Spence, also known as Simon Dudfield. I'm actually an author, so in the UK, you know, I write quite well-known music books. But now we're talking about Fabulous, and we're talking to Mark on anxiety performance. No? Is it performance anxiety? So, yeah. So, what it is, okay, I've got it now. You know, my name is Simon Spence. I'm an author in the UK. I'm probably best known by, you know, the music books I've written, but we're talking to Mark on performance anxiety about a band me and Martin formed 30 years ago when we were both at the NME. We were both working at the NME, and we got this band together and caused quite a stir, you know. But it has been 30 years, and Martin is a successful photographer. You know, I was a fairly successful music journalist, and after that slight hiccup with Fabulous, I've gone on to do quite a lot of books. So, looking forward to Breaking America. You know, we're coming back to break America.
Hi, I'm Martin Goodacre, and I was a member of Fabulous that played guitar and helped write the songs. And that's why we're here today, to talk about Fabulous, really. Apart from that, I'm a photographer, sort of almost famous once. And I'm doing a record label as well at the moment, Das Wasteland. And fire away, Simon. Let's hear some Fabulous stories. What are we actually talking about?
Well, Fabulous.
Fabulous. Okay. Well, Simon will probably do most of the talking then.
Oh, excellent. Well, let's get into it. First of all, thank you guys for coming on the podcast. I'm really excited about this. This is really a hell of a story. I don't think I've heard anything like this outside of Spinal Tap.
Yeah, it was a lot like Spinal Tap. It was particularly with our bass players. I mean, Martin will tell you, but we formed with a good friend of Martin's, Ronnie. Kieran Flynn on bass guitar, who sadly recently died.
Oh wow, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. He went to the grave in a coffin that was. We had a car in our heyday, which was dubbed the Fabmobile.
Right,
and it was spray painted all over, not quite like John Lennon's Rolls Royce, but in a similar fashion, but by an artist called Paul Cannell, who was well known for doing the cover of Screamadelica over here, the Primal Scream album.
Yeah.
He spray painted the car. He had lots of his insignia all over it. And on the back, it had Arrest Me. And Ronnie's friends had arranged it so that his coffin was very similar to the car, and it had Arrest Me on the back of the coffin. So the last thing you saw was the coffin going in with Arrest Me on the back of it.
Oh, wow.
But Ronnie, we had a manager. We didn't really have any manager, to be honest with you. We had a guy who was the Enemy assistant editor, James Brown, and he went on to found Loaded magazine. But James was quite highly strung, and you know, many times we had sit down meetings with top level record industry executives, and I mean, I can remember sitting in these meetings being promised a lot of money, and then somehow James never really managed to seal the deal.
Oh no.
But James sacked Ronnie. We supported the Beastie Boys, did a show over here at the Marquee. I mean, I can't remember what year, 91 maybe. And we supported the Beastie Boys, and Ronnie turned up and he was wearing a bathrobe and a shower cap. And
that was a sackable offense. But to that story, there's another story before that, because we had a rehearsal before we did the gig at the Marquee Club with the Beastie Boys. And James, our manager at the time, walks in to our rehearsal with all three Beastie Boys. Oh. And then they said, can we have a go? And so they played our instruments, and we just sat there, you know. I was a bit gobsmacked anyway. I was like, what? I can't believe the Beastie Boys are there. And We should have got on the mics and gone crazy, but instead we just said, like, okay, that's cool. We really need to practice now, so can you mind just giving us our guitars back?
Oh, my God.
I still cringe at that moment now, you know, because instead of, like, going crazy on the mics, we were like, okay, that's good. You can play a bit of guitar, so what?
But that sound is like it went with the attitude of the band. But before we get too far into that, I kind of want to know how the band formed, because you guys weren't technically musicians when the band formed. Were you playing in bands before?
Let me just finish the Spinal Tap, because after Ronnie, we must have had eight. I mean, the band was only going for about a year,
right?
Maybe just over a year, but we had about eight subsequent bass players.
Oh my gosh.
They didn't keep dying, but...
Well, we had Keanu Reeves as a bass player for a short while.
Yeah. I heard about that. You guys got to tell that story, but we've got to build up to that one.
I'll start it, and then Simon can go back to the details. But for me... I got a call from James, and he said, look, we've got Keanu Reeves with us, and we're going to go and rehearse. And I thought, yeah, whatever. I hadn't seen them for a couple of days. And then it was dark, and I got into the car, the Fabmobile, which is an old Austin 1800, the ugliest, ridiculous car you could ever imagine, spray-painted Arrest Me, as Simon was saying. And I got in the car, and there's nobody on the back seat. Simon's in the front, Simon and James are in the front. I sit on the back seat, and then from the bit where you keep all your luggage, a head pops up, and it's kind of going, hi, man. Like it's Bill and fucking Ted together. and then we drove to... I'll let Simon carry on then, because, I mean, I don't know how you met. I think you met him in a club, didn't you, the night before?
Yeah. So Keanu was, I mean, there was publicity. There was a lot of publicity about that, Mark. But Keanu was a bass player. We had the chap who went on to play with Mark Ronson and Jamiroquai.
Oh, okay.
Stuart, he was the bass player for a little while.
Yeah, Stuart Zender, who married an Old Saint as well.
And oh, wow.
I recently just heard an interview with him on the radio, Stuart Zender, and they said, because he's a funky bass player, he's basically Stevie Wonder. They said, but did you play in a punk band once? And he went a bit quiet. he said, yeah, they were called Fabulous, but they were anything but. I thought, fuck you.
Yeah.
He didn't even want to practice with us because he was so funky.
Oh, well, hey, you know, funky and punky don't always go together.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Without a healthy mind, being truly happy and at peace is hard. The good news is therapy works. But what is therapy exactly? It's whatever you want it to be. Maybe you're not feeling motivated right now and would like some tools to help. Or maybe you're feeling insecure in relationships or at work, not dealing well with the stress. Whatever you need, it's time to stop being ashamed of normal human struggles and start feeling better because you deserve to be happy. And now you don't have to worry about finding an in-person therapist near you to help. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. Try doing that in person. So join the millions of people who are seeing what online therapy is really about. It's always a good time to invest in yourself because you are your greatest asset. And a special offer to Performance Anxiety listeners, you can get 10% off your first month of professional therapy at betterhelp.com/performanceanxiety. That's betterhelp.com/performanceanxiety. Thanks again to BetterHelp for sponsoring this podcast.
So,
yeah, because he plays the bass up here, you know, Mark King out of that level 42, isn't he?
Oh, yeah.
You can't slap to a bit of punk, really, can you?
No.
I mean, unless it's by accident.
Right.
You can slap by accident, but not on purpose.
Right. You guys were working at New Music Express, NME, when the band formed, but you weren't actually musicians at the time. You're a journalist and a photographer. Were you in bands prior to this? Did you guys play music before Fabulous formed?
I had been in a few bands, and I started playing guitar about 15. And to this day now, I know nothing more than I did in that first like 2 weeks of learning myself to play guitar. I wouldn't say we were actually musicians in any way, but the great thing about the attitude of punk was that you don't have to be a musician. I mean, I hate musicians. They're so boring. Yeah, and I hate these talented people who are either noodling away. Because to me, it's all about the message, the attitude, and the idea that you don't have to be fucking quiet to listen to. I go to gigs now and people are shushing me. And I don't know what it's like for you, but Germany is quite weird with gigs where I live now. And you can't even really shout at the band, you know, like, "You're shit, get off," without somebody turning around and, like, basically almost kicking you out.
Wow.
Although we did get kicked out of a Manic Street Preachers concert for, I don't know what we were doing wrong, but I got thrown out. Getting overexcited.
Oh, my gosh. Simon, what about you? Were you in bands before?
No. This was my last and first and only band. but what it was that Martin was slightly older than me. So Martin had come from a beautiful location in the UK before we met in London, and in the countryside called Malvern, which is Elgar. Right, Martin? Algar
lived there, yeah. My next neighbour was, what's the violinist called?
Nigel Kennedy.
Nigel Kennedy was my next door neighbour.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so Malvern was a beautiful place, and that's where Martin had grown up. And so Martin had been in bands, and really Martin had a ready-made band. So although I'd never done anything before, Martin had friends, Russell Underwood, Ronnie, who we talked about, and Robert Hodges, the drummer. So Martin had played in bands with those three before. So it was kind of, I think what happened was, you know, me and Martin used to get sent on assignments together. So we'd go and interview bands together. Martin would do the photographs. I'd do the writing. And I don't know. I think one time something was going on in the offices at the NME, the New Musical Express. I mean, it was the major music paper in the UK at the time.
Yeah.
And I was pissed off about something or other, and Martin got me back to his place, his flat, and I think that's how it started. You know, we were angry. I was angry about something, and then we went to Malvern and started. I think first of all we were going to be like a Stone Roses type Happy Mondays, kind of era.
We were just going to jump on the bandwagon,
but
our drummer can only play a 4/4 fast and hard. So, and then we have to punch that information into him. Yeah. Yeah, so he's actually still living in the countryside there actually as well.
Oh wow!
So once we got started, we just went punk, and that was it, really. Yeah. You know, we knew that because we had lots of contacts in the business that we'd probably get written about. And, you know, that's how the first gig was reviewed in the NME. You know, maybe the second gig, we had a full page spread in the face. God. And that was via a sort of girl that I knew at the time. And ID magazine, you know, that was again through another girl we knew. So within the first sort of month of being a band, you know, we had a lot of record companies knocking on the door or trying to get hold of us, or, you know, and a lot of coverage. So we weren't really a normal band, you know, we would play like in those early days, which were the best gigs for me, was like 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
Wow.
In a nightclub.
Yeah. Always in a nightclub, a London nightclub. And then we'd, you know, so yeah, those early days were, for me, the best. And then it started to get like people, we had a tour booked to the first tour. And I remember, you know, you have to play at least 30 minutes to get paid.
Oh, okay.
You know, that sort of thing. And
so you did your set twice.
Yeah. You know, we rarely got paid because we used to, I used to sort of smash all the monitors and the microphone stands and whatever. So we would always be getting into quite a lot of trouble, you know, I'm not getting paid.
I heard you guys on the first tour got banned from the majority of the venues that you played.
Yeah, well, we did. Yeah, we got arrested a couple of times. We got arrested once for stealing a vending machine out of a motorway service station. It was a Roger the Rabbit vending machine. I got photos. They put us in the cells and just chucked us out in the morning. I got arrested again after a gig where somebody had given me some weird painkiller or something like that. And I ended up smashing. We were traveling then in a London taxi, which was mine. And I ended up smashing the car up while that all the band slept in it with a crook lock. And then I think Hodge, the drummer, told the police, actually, he's over there. I did this while I was naked as well. So I just show how much of the plot I'd lost. And then I, they took me to put me in the cells again that night. Nothing serious, but, you know, it was getting a bit out of hand.
Yeah. He was singing... God gave rock and roll to me as well.
Because we
didn't really cut our teeth, because the first gigs were, you know, in very sort of hip London nightclubs. So we would come on. It was sort of just it was still in the rave era, you know, the acid house rave era. Oh, okay. So we would come on, and there would already be that. Sort of shock and awe to be a punk band there.
Simon, tell the story about those cunts, Radiohead.
Yeah, so they opened up. They opened for you guys at one point.
Well, not only did they open up for us, well, we did, because we were a hardworking band. We played two gigs that night. One of them was at Barrowlands in Glasgow, which is a big venue. Maybe 2,000 people.
Okay.
Supporting some rubbish band. And then we headlined at King Tut's Wawa Hut, where Radiohead was supporting us. And we finished the first gig, which was brilliant. And the crowd sort of loved us and then booed us at the same time.
That's a quality gig, man.
So we get to King Tut's Wawa Hut, and there's like the Radiohead have set up, and they've got all their wires and everything hanging out, you know, all these sophisticated equipment. And we said, look, to save us sound checking, why don't we just use your equipment? And of course, they said no. And they weren't very nice about it either. So we said, okay, take it down. So they had to take all of their thing apart. We put on stage these two tiny little amplifiers, just had thunder cords, said that'll do. And then they had to re-sound check themselves again then. And they didn't talk to us, and they played to 8 people. We played to about 30, I think, at the most. But they were so miserable. You could see,
I think they just got signed to EMI, so they had like that massive backline, didn't they? All
the first album, I'm not even sure, but they weren't that popular at the time. They weren't as popular as they are now. Let's put it that way.
Right. Yeah.
I don't remember the Beastie Boys coming to rehearsal, but I don't really remember much. The thing I remember about that gig is there was a guy at the front shouting, "You're not punk. You're not punk. You're not real." And then I got so fed up, I booted the guy in the face.
That was
not that gig. Bust all his nose.
Oh, God.
And then I thought afterwards we kind of went to the dressing room and he's there, he's coming. So I thought, oh, my God, he's going to come and have it's a fight now. Yes. And more equal now because I've not got 2 foot up on the stage. And right. He came back and he said, oh, I love you guys. You are punk. You proved it by kicking me in the face, So.
Okay. That's true. So,
I bought this pretty cheap guitar just so I could smash it up on the first song. Like most people smash it up at the end. I thought, okay, I'll smash it up on the first song. I took the guitar off and I started trying to do Pete Townsend, really smashing it around like that. And it didn't break. And then this guy jumped up from the audience, picked up my guitar, and in one go smashed it to pieces. And I just had to stand there. Quite an offensive gig that was. But yeah. Praying Mantis turf and Beastie Boys.
Oh my God.
So sometimes we would be banned for, we did behave like spoiled brats a lot of the time, but we felt that was appropriate. But it was, we'd get banned for things like, we didn't like the food that the promoter had prepared. And so that would go all over the wall. And, or I do recall setting fire to a dressing room one time.
Oh my God.
And another time, there were incidents. We had a t-shirt that was, that Paul Cannell, again, the Screamadelica artist who's dead now, he designed a t-shirt for us that had an erect penis on the cover.
Yes.
Actually, it's the cover of the CD.
Yes.
But with a banana.
I thought that was you, Simon.
That's not me, Guy.
That's you on a t-shirt, isn't it?
That's not me. No,
it looks just like you.
People say it looks a little bit like me, but it's definitely not me. But it is a man holding his erect, laying back, holding an erect penis. And that was illegal. I think it still is illegal. We argued that, you go into, I don't know what it's like in the US, but UK garages to get your petrol, and they used to have lots of pornographic magazine. So it was okay for women to be displayed like that. But we said, well, there's the erect penis. And so sometimes we'd get banned because of that, they wouldn't want the t-shirt or...
Students didn't like it.
I heard that was actually a very popular t-shirt design for you guys.
They sold like hotcakes.
Yes.
I mean, we should have made more, really. But yeah. We'd lost the plot by then.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors.
Hey, guys, I want to talk to you about socks for a second. Why not? It's a music podcast. But I tried a pair of socks from Boldfoot and loved them. I've only worn them once because my kids have stolen them. So in my household, that's the best endorsement I can give. And I guess it's fitting because the design I chose was jailbait. Wait, jailbird. The design I chose was jailbird. I might keep that in. The socks are 100% American made and 5% of all proceeds go to veteran charities.
It makes sense, seeing that Boltfoot is a family and veteran-owned company. They have a huge variety of styles. So check out boltfoot.com and buy some of the best socks you've ever slapped on your feet. And help veterans while you're at it. That's boltfoot.com.
So we weren't very organized, you know. We weren't very, we thought we'd do about 10 gigs and then get signed to a £1 million record deal. I mean, that was really the idea.
Yeah.
So we weren't, you know, so we had a shocking t-shirt. That was just part of it. It wasn't like, let's do the merchandise. And it wasn't really like that, you know. But I think that t-shirt, somebody said, you know, on eBay, or it's quite, you know, I don't think you can get it back. I think Jeff might have said it was like $100 or something like that for someone who'd got one. But I don't have one. So
it's on our new compilation sleeve, though. But there's a instead of the erect penis now, there's a Velvet Underground banana on it for some reason.
I hope
you could peel it off.
Oh, now that's some packaging right there.
Yeah, you know, we that was what we discussed with Jeff, but I think, you know, the costing was an issue.
So you guys recorded just a couple of singles, I guess it ended up being three singles. You recorded an entire album's worth of stuff, but only ended up releasing three singles. You worked with Peter Waterman, who was known more for pop music, and that reflected in the album title, produced by Kylie. How did you guys end up working with Peter Waterman?
With Waterman, it was the first single we recorded with. I'll give you the Waterman. Waterman was me and Martin went to interview. There was a period where just when the band started, the NME would still let me write for them.
Okay,
and then they got to a point where, you know, maybe we're in the Guardian newspaper, or there was a point where the band got too popular or too well known for me to continue. They wouldn't let it. But in that brief period, me and Martin went to interview Malcolm McLaren, and Martin took pictures of McLaren posing all around the Fabmobile. and we talked to Malcolm about the band, and he said, you know, if you really want to make an impact, you have to sign with Peter Waterman, who was in this country best known. I don't think he's ever broken America, but in this country it was Kylie Minogue, Jason Donovan, you know, a lot of sort of manufactured pop act. So I don't think, I mean, me and Martin wrote the songs, but I don't think either of us would claim to be great songwriters. So the idea that Waterman would write our hits was very appealing.
Okay.
And in a way, like maybe like Zig Zig Sputnik.
Okay.
Maybe something along, you know. So initially, Waterman had a Belgian hardcore techno producer making the music for us. And we would have to rewrite the lyrics with Stock Aitken and Waterman.
Oh, is that the guy from Lords of Acid?
The producer, but I don't know. I don't even know what his name was. You know, we weren't very interested in music. You know, we weren't very interested in, you know, we were interested in music, but we weren't really that bothered about. Okay. I can't remember the guy's name, you know.
I think, I believe, and if I'm reading it right, I believe it was Praga Khan from Lords of Acid.
Yeah, Praga Khan rings a bell, yeah. It was Praga Khan.
I remember going to a meeting, and Waterman said, okay, bring in some records of the stuff that you want to sound like. And I took in Curtis Mayfield. He goes, you've got to be fucking joking. You're never going to be able to do this. And then Simon showed him like Raw Power by Iggy Pop, and he goes, yeah, that's where we're at. we did something with Andrew Lou Golden as well, which was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
The Stones
was that the Stones cover that you guys did? Was that what you did with him?
And the world has stopped. Danny and Flock now dressed up just like Union Jack. Sees I'm worth 5 pounds if I have his kind of detergent pack.
Or was that something different?
It was during that time, because he put us in touch with his partner, Calder. Then they sent us to some sort of somebody's shed outside London to practice with the guy who never even heard of Nirvana, who was the biggest band at the time. We were like, what the fuck are we doing here? But things were starting. It was starting to fold up by then. Anyway, you know, we'd been through so much, and that the fact that we were like devolving rather than evolving was. you could see the danger signs, really.
All right, you okay?
Yeah, good. Yeah.
Okay, I just heard a clunk. Just making sure. There we go.
I was just thinking, you know, it's lucky we didn't get big at the time. We'd be even in a worse state that we're in now.
Well, I probably wouldn't have gotten you on the podcast.
Can you hear me?
Oh, now I can. I can see, every time you mute, I can. It shows that you've muted on the screen.
I didn't mute, though. I just slipped it over to number one on those dots at the bottom.
I think because you might be swiping the wrong way. This is all.
What about now? Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. This is all got to stay.
Okay, I don't know why the thing's not working, but we'll waste time otherwise. So.
No problem. All right. So you guys are working with Paul, or Peter, sorry, Peter, hey, Paul, maybe Mary, I don't know. So this is after the first singles come out, the Destined to Be Free with There's a Riot Going On, which I love. I really love There's a Riot Going On. That's a great track. some reason they bring Praga Khan in to write songs for you guys. Everything kind of goes off the rails, though.
Yeah, yeah.
The album never comes out. What happened?
Well, the first single was Enemy Single of the Week. For Heavenly Records, which was quite a hip record label. It had Manic Street Preachers, Not the Charlatans, what's that other one? Saint Etienne. Flowered Up. They had quite, you know, it was a very fashionable record label. And
Lanigan.
They wanted to do our second single as well. And they wanted Andy Weatherall to produce us.
Oh, wow.
This is another massive regret. Because,
I mean, well, we said no, fuck off, Andy Weatherall, basically, isn't that?
Yeah, well, he
or maybe I did. Maybe I did. I don't know.
He came to our gig and he was like a heavy metal biker with hair down to his waist, tattoos everywhere.
Oh my gosh!
And we'd had a fight on stage where the sound man or something like that was wrestling with Simon on stage to save a piece of equipment, which was a mic stand, I think, not even a microphone, that Simon was trashing in great style. And Andy Weatherall goes, it's just fucking brilliant. I'll love to do the next single with you. Or I think it might have even been the first single anyway. And we just thought, like, I really liked him. But... for some reason, we thought we didn't need an acid house DJ to produce our record. I mean, that is the biggest. It's worse than the Beast not jamming with the Beastie Boys, you know, asking them for our instruments back.
Yeah, we at the time, because Andy Weatherall was so ubiquitous, he was producing Primal Scream. He was the go-to guy in the record industry as a producer.
Yeah.
For some reason, I decided, no thanks. We're going to sign with Kylie Minogue. You know, we're going to follow what Malcolm McLaren has told us. And so, that's sliding doors. It could have gone a different way at that juncture.
But the one thing is that I'm really quite happy that we never got really big, because we probably would be total wankers by now.
Or dead.
And all of that money would not have helped, made me happier in any possible way. Maybe. We turned down 40,000. This is in 1991. We turned down £40,000 non-payable. We didn't have to pay it back.
Oh.
Just because we thought we could get more.
Oh, wow.
We couldn't get any more. Then the phone stopped. Suddenly, to put things in perspective, right, we would all be sitting around headquarters, my apartment in Southeast London. The phone would constantly ring. We'd pick the phone up and go, no, and slam it back down.
Oh, wow.
It got to that stage, and then suddenly the phone sort of stopped ringing. And we were suddenly out traveling around every toilet venue in Britain supporting the Buzzcocks, I think, on a 30-date tour without a hotel, without anywhere to sleep, without any money at all. We even had to paid for them to use their lights, you know. So that really burnt us out, I think.
Yeah. Well, Waterman sacked us. He had his TV show in the UK. It was a late night TV show broadcast from a nightclub, and he invited us to play, and we were in the middle of some sort of string of dates that were probably going badly, and because it was very late at night that the TV show was on TV, we were kind of off our heads by the time it got to filming, and that was the point that Waterman didn't want to work with us anymore.
Oh, wow.
He'd had enough, you know, so that
I
is...
I think he was looking for any excuse to get out.
Do you think so?
Well, he'd hardly done any work for a year. I think we were with him for not a year, but...
It might have seemed like a year, because we were trying to, you know, because it was every day trying to get hold of him, say what's going on. So
yeah, well, and then
we couldn't get through anymore. We couldn't get through to speak to him.
He said he's not in. He's not in, and he won't be in for the foreseeable future.
He will be in every time you call.
Yeah. So that's when we went to America to try and, because really we'd burn all our bridges in the UK.
So we wanted to break America.
Yeah, that's it. You got to burn them in America too.
It was 1992, and punk had just got to America. The American thing was, Simon should tell his story in its entirety, because I wasn't there, and I still blame Simon and James for fucking everything up really badly.
So is this...
Because they had a meeting with Seymour Stein.
Yeah, and Mo Austin, right?
Mo Austin, Rick Rubin.
Whoa!
There was some cat from Sony Records who'd signed the Manic Street Preachers. so that was... there was strong interest in America, but we did balls it up. Yeah, we balls that right up, me and James.
James Brown, our manager at the time, said basically he had his checkbook with him and he could have written us anything.
Wow.
But lack of preparation.
Yeah, I think we...
They didn't even take a tape or a video of us or anything. And then... And then I think they were just shit-faced at the meeting. I don't know what happened. I wasn't there.
Well, we did take a tape. We took a videotape of, like, clips. We've been on TV in the UK. You know, we never really had a record deal. Even that first single with Heavenly, It was done on a handshake. Ronnie had sorted it out. It was done on a handshake. So we never had a record deal.
Wow.
And but we did get on, you know, but we were on like mainstream TV shows. So we took a video, which was clips of TV shows and a bit of live stuff. I don't know, 10 minutes of the best stuff, we thought. But then when we were in the big meeting, that was when we realized that the UK video format and the American video format were slightly different. And so our videotape wouldn't play.
Oh.
And then James said, can you get your top off, Simon? Because he thought that by, you know, because I had a bit of a physique then. So he thought that by parading around topless, that would
that'll get you a record deal.
That would get us a record deal. He also said, I was going to be the, he said, Simon's going to be the next Billy Idol. Forget about the band. Simon right. will be the next Billy Idol. If that's what he said.
Oh my
God. He was selling me out.
In desperation. But then we were ill prepared for the, even after that, they took us out for this big meal. And yeah, we'd spent some time with the Beastie Boys and, I don't know. We'd been up a lot. We'd been up many days, and we were badly behaved at that meeting. Also, you know, Mark, it was.
Oh my God!
But Nick Rubin wanted to produce us, and even after that, the guy from Sony Records who'd signed the Manic Street Preachers, he wanted to continue working with us, and he had Kim Fowley lined up to produce us.
Wow.
And then I don't know what happened, but I do remember me and James ended up in San Francisco with the Grateful Dead, the Grateful Dead psychiatrist's hot tub and arguing with James saying, you don't even know what you want. You don't know if you want to be a proper band and record an album and do more albums, or you just want to do one album and then, like the Sex Pistols. I mean, it was all very Sex Pistols.
Right, yeah. You know?
And it was like, well, I don't know. It all fell apart, really. James fell apart at that point and really started to go, you know, he'd had a lot of problems in his family. And yeah. He'd started to go.
The story I remember is that they were so disgusted, Seymour Stein, that they all just left the dinner table and left with James and Simon having to pay the bill, which was obviously in a very expensive restaurant.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and then James, I can't remember where I got or how I got there. Like, I can't remember a lot of this stuff, but I do remember James, I can't get into it, with Seymour Stein. He just, I think Seymour Stein quite liked the look of Russell, the guitarist, the other guitarist, and... I can't remember why James went off with Seymour to try and rescue the deal somehow. And, you know, but Rick Rubin would have been quite good, I think, you know, would have been good to work with as well. But the same as Andy Weatherall, you know, it was never to be, really.
Yeah. So where is the music that you recorded been for 30 years? I mean, has it been in your hands? Has it been in somebody else's possession? Because it's been kind of, I almost want to say mythical, that it's been recorded and nobody knew what happened.
I asked James, because he had the master tapes on 2-inch tape of some of the recordings. He goes, I threw those away ages ago.
Oh.
When I was cleaning the house.
Oh, my God.
I had a couple of the master tapes, and I sent them to Jeff, and one of them wasn't even us. he said, what about this track? And I said, that's not us. He said, oh, thank God for that. Basically. Okay. He's like, jingle jangle pop bollocks.
He did have, there are some recordings that Jeff has got for the album that I don't recall actually recording, but obviously we did, you know, but I don't really remember doing it, you know, so.
Amazing.
So there was bits and bobs, I guess, that we did. And here it all is now on CD with a nice booklet. You know, we always said that, you know, really the hype was something to see, you know, all the media coverage that we managed to get for ourselves, you know, from very you know, from very little talent, let's be honest. And you know, and then to get this sort of tsunami of publicity was so it's nice to see in the CD, you know, some of that publicity collected, you know, for the booklet. And and actually the music doesn't sound that bad. I always thought it sounded much worse than this, you know.
I played it to somebody the other day, and they said it still stands quite well, because it's sort of more a classic punky sound than what was going on. And we were at the time in the UK, there was this movement, the shoegazing movement.
Oh yeah.
And bands were getting, you know, they had this sort of sonic sound, but they were really boring on stage because they were looking at their foot pedals all the time.
Right.
And we wanted to just sort of rock out, you know, like shaking our tits to the hits.
Right. So why release it 30 years after?
Well, actually, I started talking to Jeff about 10 years ago. it's taken 10 years.
So the band exists for a total of 18 months or so, and then everything else takes forever.
Yeah.
I think we just had to let it lie for a while because it really burnt us out anyway. Yeah. I mean, I'm glad we, you know, it's out. It's great to have it out, you know, really.
Yeah, I concur with what Martin said earlier. It was probably a lucky escape because, you know, say, even with that limited amount of success we had, we did sort of go a bit OTT, and I think any more success would have, some of us did go quite mad, you know, and, you know, it would have been even worse, but it's well, not.
Russell, the second guitarist we had at the time, the original liner, he lost control halfway through a tour after taking some LSD, and yeah, he sort of vanished, basically.
Oh, wow. So
we lost.
He walked off stage mid-gig, wasn't it, Martin? He walked off stage. And
he walked off stage, never to be seen again. Well, for a while, but actually living with me at the time, so I did see him. he locked himself in his bedroom, and occasionally his girlfriend would come out and go, can you help me with Russell? And I was going, I can't face these. It was quite dark, actually.
Wow.
But he came through. You know, he's sort of okay now. And he's quite enthusiastic about this project as well, so it's great. Sort of brought us back together a bit.
That's been the good thing about it, catching up, because we never sat around for 30 years, you know, like what could have been, pissing in our pints, you know. It was... We just got on, you know. It was difficult after being a music journalist and then suddenly fronting that band. It's difficult to get back into music journalism, you know, because for photographers, I always thought it was easier. For Martin and Russell, who was also a photographer at the NME, because I'd been like the mouthpiece or the front person. So I'd been doing all the shouting about how great we were and how terrible everyone else was. Right. So it was quite difficult, you know, and striding about in these yellow trousers.
I just remembered another story then when Suede, this British Britpop, pre-Britpop band, supported us in South London, and we met them on the stairs. It was Brett Anderson and Bernard Butler. And they said, "You hate us, don't you?" We said, Yes, we hate everyone. And they sort of minced off, you know, into the distance with their, you know,
dressed
in black. And so, you know, things caught up with us as well because we were slagging everyone off. So when the initial shock of us suddenly being apparent became apparent, basically people couldn't wait to get the knives in when things started to go slightly downhill.
Right. I've actually had the chance to listen to the album, and it's really cool, man. The singles are great, but the two tracks that are my favorite, that stand out to me the most, I love Dead Friends. A single for you guys. So you guys released, that was, I think, the last single?
Yeah. I think. That was on King Late label that I set up a label for that. That song was actually about a bass player who nearly played with us. But he
Number
died
nine.
Actually before. He was the bass player with Iggy Pop, and he had joined a band called The Hypnotics. And
yes, I know them.
He followed us around on tour. He loved being with us. And then he was great as well. I mean, he's a proper musician, so he could actually play. So right. He teach us a little bit. And then he was with The Hypnotics, and they all sort of lived together in a squat in South London, and they were looking for a cup to make a cup of tea with. And they walked into his room, and he'd been dead for like 2 days.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, never. So that was what that song's about, is dead friends, really. It's like,
What was he called, Martin?
Craig.
Craig, yeah, he died. I think we can claim Craig as like the 10th bass player, and he died. That's another Spinal Tap.
That is but so Tap.
We used to call him Sludge.
Really?
Really?
I have no idea why.
I got his leather trousers. Do you remember?
Got them.
No, I've not got them now, but I can't imagine
wearing them
off the dead body.
Yeah, come on, let's see.
But I did get his leather trousers off him. Yeah. So The Hypnotics, yeah, that was sort of what that was about. That was, that is a good one. Yeah, that's all right, that one.
That's insane. Well, all right, so the other song that I should say is my other favorite, and maybe you guys got a crazy story about this one, is Capitol Gold.
Story about it. I think Martin wrote that.
No more dead people
with that one.
Yeah, Cup of Gold was just about how boring the radio was at the time in London.
Yeah. Oh, that's not crazy at all.
The indie thing was getting, you know, like I said earlier with the shoegaze and stuff, it was getting a bit boring. So we, you know, just basically saying how boring the radio is in London.
Okay.
And with a few other sort of things.
Man, I kind of blew the load there with the dead bassist. I should have asked that one second.
A lot of Spinal Tap, yeah. But it was, I think because we weren't in the studio very much, we never got... I just remember the first single, which was that There's a Riot Going On. We didn't know what we were doing, so I remember Ronnie saying, oh, can you make him sound like he's in a dustbin? On my vocals. That was suddenly it. It wasn't, and I think with Capitol Gold, it was like there was, you know, we never, I don't know if we could have evolved. Potentially we could have, you know, I guess bands do, you know, some bands have, you know, maybe they go away for a few years and then come back. But
yeah.
For us, it was, this is just, we know that never happened to us. Oh. You know, I always say we were, we weren't punk rock, we were prank rock.
Yeah.
You know, that's how I like to categorize it, you know,
like
really.
That.
Yeah, prank rock.
Remember where you heard that first?
Exactly. That's going to be the hashtag for this episode. So are there any other tracks in the vault to come out later on, maybe?
I've got a new track ready to go, but it's basically just me, but I'm going to put out under Fabulous at some point.
Oh, awesome. The album is, well, by the time this comes out, the album will be out.
It's in top Billboard top 100 countdown.
What are there plans for you guys? Anything beyond just releasing the album, or is there going to be more music coming out? Or
Jeff, who put the CD together, who used to work for Ryko Discs, he says Keanu Reeves is interested in having some of these songs on his new movie. I'm not sure which movie it is.
I think it's The Matrix.
And, you know, I'm going to maybe chase up that offer from Rick Rubin. I mean, we can't do Andy Weatherall. He's dead now, but maybe. Rick Rubin. I'm going to chase up Rick.
I was thinking,
forget about Martin and Russell. I'm thinking of just going straight to L.A., and getting some like hair metal
you
band.
Should reach out to Billy Idol.
Oh, yeah. Maybe I could step in to Billy Idol.
I've got a story. Going back to Andy Weatherall, I went to see a premiere of a movie with James about a couple of years ago, and there was this guy with a big beard, and James and him started talking. His girlfriend was there, and I started, you know, and we were having a really cool conversation, and I thought, God, this guy is so familiar. And then at the end of it, Jay said, Andy Weatherall, he was Andy Weatherall, basically. And he said, okay, see you later. He goes, okay, see you, Andy. And I thought, that's Andy Weatherall. I really want to apologize.
Andy. Yeah. We've probably got quite a few people to apologize to, really, if you... I'd like to take this opportunity to apologize to Martin, because... We did support Zodiac Mind Warp, who was like a biker rocker. And
oh my God, I've heard that in there.
You know, I managed to get away. I did the usual, which was booting all the monitors off stage and trashing whatever equipment I could get my hands on. And I think Zodiac Mind Warp had some, I'm not sure they were bikers. And they came on stage to get me, and I managed to run out into the audience and out the front door of the venue and was away on my toes. But I think they got hold of Martin, and Martin went to hospital that night. So
No.
I think that's the apology.
They kidnapped us, basically. They locked us in a room and then came in occasionally to beat us.
Oh my God. I was off down the high street. I was on the
Simon, I was just getting a glass of wine, but you ran straight off the stage as the fight started. One of the bouncers hit me over the back with one of those old style metal fire extinguishers.
Oh my God.
That put me to the ground.
Oh my God. God.
And I wasn't doing anything. I didn't do anything. I was just playing a guitar. They were after Simon. Yeah. Simon ran through the crowd and straight out into the streets of London, of Croydon, or wherever it was.
You guys need to do it.
There wasn't Croydon, was it? Hillsford.
Yeah, it was my fault that, yeah.
You guys need to do a follow-up album and title it Kidnapped by Zodiac Mind Warp.
It wasn't Zodiac Mind Warp. I don't think they were even paid any attention. It was the bouncers at this place called the Ilford Island who were...
What was it?
He used to deal with, like, thugs, basically. Oh. They couldn't believe it when we started smashing up their stage and their lights. They really didn't like it.
Oh, well, yeah.
Because they took total offense.
Where can people find the album? How can they get a hold of the album? And is there a social media presence for the band or for you guys personally that you'd like to share? I like that. Thanks.
I have no idea, actually. I thought it was already out. And we were already in the Billboard Top 100.
Oh, I love you guys.
And Lady Gaga wants to now do something with us.
Yeah. A collab.
The offer's buying in.
So where can they get the album? Where is it going to be, on streaming platforms, or do you have to buy a physical copy?
Yeah, I hope so. You're asking the wrong person here, really.
Yeah, Jeff would be the person to ask. We've got some physical CDs, so I imagine there are going to be physical CDs in the USA, and I imagine Jeff will put it on Spotify as well.
Is there a social media presence at all?
Thing, social media, again, we don't really, Jeff is we don't do any of that. I mean, I've just finished a book with...
we're artists. We don't have to deal with social media.
Yeah. Well... Guys,
I think there's a Facebook site, maybe, or something like that.
Do you remember playing in Manchester, Martin, when the guy shouted out Sham 69?
Certainly, I remember that. Yeah, that was a great game.
From the audience, he shouted out Sham 69.
Yeah, that was cool.
And I was so insulted at that particular point, but now I really quite like Sham 69. It was a compliment.
Didn't you guys?
But at the time, I was like horrified. No, we're more like the MC5. What are you talking about?
Were you guys
not Sham 69?
Legend.
Well, I'm sorry.
Legend has it you guys recorded a cover of Woolly Bully.
Andrew Lou Goldham thought it was a great idea. We should do this song. I think because he owns the rights for it, or something like that. But they're trying to get. I've never heard that bloody song, and it's like that. I hate. But now I thought that it's probably a really good idea. We could have brought back proper rock and roll, like the Stray Cats, or you know, Shawaddy Waddy. It probably would have sounded like, wouldn't it? Well, or Shanana, my favorite. Oh.
There you go, Bowser. Yeah.
We could have done Let's Go to the Hoppers, the B-side.
Oh, my God. You guys are doing that. I actually would have bought that. I still
You could come back as a pure rock and roll band, because I only listen to pure rock and roll now anyway. I don't, you know. And right-wing punk.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Well, guys... I don't want this to end mid-story, so...
Okay.
Really...
Thanks for your time, Mark. It's much appreciated, you know?
Well, I'm in with you guys. I'm completely bought into Fabulous.
I can't believe you actually like it, though. I mean...
I'll tell you, I honestly love Dead Friends, and I love Capitol Gold. Poor Petrol Interface. I mean...
Pour petrol in the face is...
It's not about pouring petrol in a woman's face.
It's not actually physically about pouring petrol in a woman's face. It's about actually burning down a country that is so messed up. And it's more messed up than it is now. You know, we have to go through this Brexit thing. And when I listened to that, I thought that was the anthem. We wrote the anthem to Brexit ages ago, to the antiphony of the... Of Brexit and this insular patriotism that Great Britain's going for, flag waving idiots everywhere, basically. And that's a powerful political song.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree.
I just want Green Day to cover it. Or who's the big punk? What's that guy called? Machine Gun Willie.
Yes, that's exactly it. Machine Gun Willie. I think he's
Kid Rock.
Steamboat. Willie?
Steamboat Mickey.
Oh, guys. Well, I'm going to look you guys up on... Martin, I've been checking out your photography. It's brilliant. I'm a photographer. Well, I was for about 12 years before I had kids. Now I just kind of do as a side. But I love it. Simon, I've got to check out your books because I wasn't familiar until we started this. So... It's a little easier to check out photos than a book. So, but I have to get into it. So,
To any publishers out there, I'd be very happy to do a book with you.
Hey,
but at the moment, I'm very busy with the Fabulous Reunion CD now available on Super Megabot Records.
Awesome, guys! Thank you so much. I really do appreciate all your time and the amazing stories. It's been just incredible. I love it. Thank you.
Thank you.